Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video from Wretched Radio, the channel with Todd Friel, the angry, spin-around-a-small-room-while-ranting guy. Well, thankfully, he's sitting down for this one, so the risk of motion sickness is minimal. But I can't promise that he's any less ranty. Let's go!
This is Wretched Radio, Answers in Genesis. Currently, thousands of people walking through a recreation of Noah's Ark. It is a magnificent museum.
Magnificently boring, from what I've heard. It's on my list of things to do if I'm ever in Kentucky before it goes bankrupt, but I feel like it's not worth a trip in and of itself.
Because that's what it is. It's not like some sort of theme park. It's a museum. Tons of teaching.
Is there hands-on stuff for the kids? Are there educational demonstrations? Exhibits that actually do things, like those that can be found in any good science museum that targets families? No, from what I've seen, it's some stuffed animals in cages, a couple of wax figures, and a bunch of signs to read. What always strikes me with Christian entertainment is just how low effort it all is. Christian music is mostly derivative and bland. It actually kind of has to be. If you want your worship song to be successful, it has to be easy enough for low-talent church worship teams to be able to learn how to play. So as long as it has a good hook and only uses basic chord progressions, it's a shoo-in. Christian movies are notoriously bad and often are where washed-up actors go to end their careers. Christian museums, like this one, are just a bunch of signs to read with minimal interaction. And the return on investment for a lot of these things is just ridiculous. The movie Fireproof, for instance, cost $500,000 to make, which is barely anything in the modern movie industry. But it brought in over $83 million in box office and DVD sales. That's a return on investment of 16,588%. But maybe that's an outlier. How about Courageous, which was basically Fireproof, but with cops instead of firefighters? Well, that one had a much more modest ROI of only 2,800%. Entertainment businesses have figured out that if you just slap the Christian label on something, there's a segment of the population that will pretty much unthinkingly eat it up. Can't have the kids watching secular movies and TV, so better subscribe to PureFlix. And this is by no means exclusive to the entertainment industry. How many tradespeople, like plumbers or general contractors, have figured out that an easy way to build a customer base is to just slap a Jesus fish on your trucks? Then there's a good bunch of people that just trust you because you're obviously a good Christian contractor who wouldn't cut corners or overcharge. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. Though, if you do see a Kickstarter to start a new Christian movie making company called Rhino Productions or something, that's probably me.
Please go with your family, and then get up to the Creation Museum a little further north. Spend a day at each, and you will be more edified, and you will be more secure in your knowledge. Genesis has a lot of answers.
Yeah, you might feel more secure in your knowledge, but no, Genesis does not have a lot of answers. Genesis has basically two answers that AIG usually focuses on. Creation happened in the way Genesis 1 and 2 described, as long as you twist Genesis 2 to fit in with the contradictory story in Genesis 1, and Noah's flood happened. Those are the two answers that AIG primarily focuses on. The rest of the ministry is devoted to twisting science to fit in with those two answers. But read through their website sometime. You will find it to be full of articles trying to explain why this obvious problem over here with their worldview isn't actually a problem, rather than them actually presenting anything genuinely new or interesting that they wouldn't have discovered if not for Genesis. So they don't find answers in Genesis. They find things that they don't like in science, and then try to squish it into Genesis.
And that's pretty catchy. Genesis has a lot of answers. We could work with that.
Not if you actually read the book, you can't. Well, I mean, I guess that depends what kind of questions you're asking. Is it okay to trick the leader of a nation into marrying your wife by telling him that she's actually your sister and then extorting him for riches when he finds out that she was really your wife? The answer to that one in Genesis is yes, on multiple occasions, with the added bonus of Abraham technically not lying because not only was she his wife, she was his half-sister too, so everything's on the up and up.
So the other night, I'm reading Answers Magazine. This is a great magazine to get for you and your family, especially if you are at all interested in science stuff at all.
No, it is a terrible magazine to get if you are actually interested in science. They warp science and sow distrust of scientific authorities by claiming that secular scientists are all out to prove creation wrong, but they keep failing somehow.
The seven best evidences of the global flood. This will ring in your ears. You are going to love this. You're going to go, yes, yes, that's right. My Bible is true.
I highly doubt it. I've read enough of it to know that it pretty much can't be true. Not in a literal sense, at any rate.
Somebody who doesn't believe in God will not receive this information. How can that be? How can two people in the same room hearing the same evidence come up with such radically different conclusions?
This is one of the very few points where I might actually agree with AIG. It's because of the worldview. One person starts with certain assumptions. That the Bible is the inerrant word of a God who actually exists, and that Genesis is meant to be taken literally, for instance. The other starts with a desire to know and understand true things, whatever they may be, while making a deliberate effort to minimize starting assumptions. And unfortunately for the Answers in Genesis people, what is true does not usually line up with what AIG wants to be true.
It's staggering to me. It's just amazing to me when you hear a scientific scoffer say, "Well, the world being covered in water, that's ridiculous." Have they never flown to Europe or the Middle East or to Asia? Look down from your window, if you've got a window seat, and they don't make you close the window and wear a mask over your head. The point is, there's a lot of water on the planet.
Two things. First, it figures that this guy is an anti-masker. It's weird how the fundamentalist Christian demographic lines up so well with the anti-mask demographic. Second, yes, there is a lot of water in the oceans. That does not mean that it's enough to cover all the land. If there were enough water in the oceans to cover all the land, then all the land would be covered. And if we look at all the water on the planet, oceans, lakes, rivers, ice caps, atmosphere, etc., the oceans represent 96% of all the water. So, no, there is not enough water to cover all the land. There's also the fact that all this water would have been completely unsurvivable for Noah and his ark. In a previous video, I ran the math, and in order to raise the sea levels just to cover Mount Ararat, so only about 60% of how high you'd actually need to get to cover Mount Everest, there would need to be 340 kilograms of rain per minute per square meter of the entire planet for the whole 40 days and 40 nights that it was supposed to have been raining for, according to the Bible. But yeah, the Bible does say that the fountains of the deep opened up, so if we're generous and say that 75% of the water came from the fountains of the deep rather than the rain, that still leaves us with 85 kilograms of rain per minute per square meter of the earth. That's the weight of a full-grown human being dropping on you every minute, 24/7 for 40 days. It would rip the ark to shreds, and the many fossilized footprints and other more delicate fossils that we have would have been washed away long before being buried and lithified.
3/4 of the earth is already covered!
And that's 96% of the water that's on the planet, so you ain't getting much more than that.
It wouldn't be that much more difficult for God to take care of the other quarter! And yet they deny it. Why?
Because it's physically impossible, to a degree that even creationists will admit, as Dr. Baumgartner stated in a paper published in a creationist research journal. His conclusion was that creationists need to be more comfortable answering unanswerable questions with "God did it," rather than trying to force science to conform to their views, because the flood is very clearly scientifically impossible. So if creationist scientists and secular scientists can all agree that the flood is a scientific impossibility, why does it surprise you that the non-creationists don't think that it happened?
To the evidence we go, courtesy of Answers Magazine. Number one, marine fossils high on mountains.
Which is actually evidence against the flood, because the dynamics of how water moves sediment during a flooding event would have the materials from the mountaintops being swept down into the valleys rather than the other way around. And that's ignoring the fact that the fossils high on the mountaintops have been known since the 1600s to have shown evidence of existing normally, as they grew naturally, rather than being scattered by a violent flood. They got to the mountaintops through uplift, a process that is still happening today.
Did you know that?
Yes, I did know that. That's one of the most basic creationist arguments, and one that has taken quite a thorough beating throughout the years.
There are marine fossils. They should be in the water way down below, and yet they're on top of the mountains. Go figure. From the magazine, fossils are one of the best evidences of a global flood.
No, fossils are one of the lines of evidence that conclusively disproves Noah's flood, because there are entire ecosystems buried one on top of the other, with zero contamination between ecosystems, and with ecosystems appearing in the exact same order all across the globe. Never do we find a fossil between layers, except for trees. Or lycopods, which are basically an ancient extinct tree analog, which I have referred to as trees in the past because, well, look at them. They are quite tree-ish. So, yeah, the only organism to have ever been found to have been fossilized through multiple layers also happens to be the only type of organism known to be capable of remaining standing upright for sometimes hundreds of years after they have died. If the flood were accurate, the fossil record should be a big jumbled mess, not neatly sorted, and animals being caught between layers should be the norm, not completely unheard of. Fossils don't help the flood.
Especially where many fossils are found. Example, we don't find marine creatures such as fish, clams, and corals buried and fossilized on the seafloor where they once lived.
I mean, we don't generally find them on the modern seafloor because paleontological digs are kind of hard to accomplish at the bottom of the sea. If you want to sponsor such a dig, I'm sure there are plenty of places down there where you would find them. In fact, studying fossilized plankton found on the ocean floor is one of the ways we map out historic ocean currents.
Huh. Instead, we find most of them buried in a sedimentary rocks on the continents, even on high mountains. For that to happen, the ocean waters had to totally flood the continents.
Or, alternately, the Earth was different during these different time periods. Sometimes there were massive inland seas. Sometimes there were arid deserts. These completely different ecosystems are represented one right on top of the other, with many other completely different ecosystems in neighboring layers, sometimes all in one location. Also, plate tectonics are a thing, which makes for the uplift that can actually scrape the seafloor onto a continent as it is being subductive, piling up the seafloor fossils and pushing them onto the continent. There are many ways that these fossils get there, and a global flood just wouldn't do the trick.
And I would even suggest recede somewhat rapidly, and that's exactly what the Bible describes.
Yeah, the Bible actually describes it as happening way too rapidly, almost like the authors were just unaware of the true scale of the Earth. Kind of what we'd expect from just normal human authors from that time and location who didn't have access to a being with infinite knowledge, like God.
Maybe somebody brought him up there. I know, Ken Ham. He went up the mountain and he just put him there so that you got that evidence. It's all a scam.
I couldn't make up a worse straw man of the scientific position if I tried. Bravo, sir. Bravo. You certainly are doing your part to make sure that your audience will be completely unprepared for the fact that we know exactly how they got up there, and we know that it would not be physically possible in a flood. You are undoubtedly creating more non-believers than you are recruiting new believers, so I applaud your efforts. Nothing helps the atheist cause, quite like preachers who don't even understand the basics of their opponent's position. Well, reading the actual Bible would do it too, but that's a lot of work for not much reward. Though, really, if you think it actually is the Word of God, what does that say about you if you haven't read it cover to cover? You think the Word of God isn't going to be important? So, if you're already an atheist, I would say don't bother with it. It's very tedious and dull. But if you're a Christian, reading at the average adult reading speed of about 200 words per minute, it would only take you 65 hours to get through it. Why would you not invest that time in reading the whole thing at least once?
Number two evidence of a global flood, massive fossil graveyards around the world.
Yes, there are some massive fossil graveyards. That's not evidence for a global flood. That's evidence for multiple local catastrophic events that had the effect of killing and burying a large number of animals at the same time. Think Pompeii. That's a lot of people and animals being buried in that city, together, at the same time. Is that evidence of a global flood? Or is that evidence of a volcanic eruption? Each fossil graveyard has to be examined independently in order to figure out what caused it, and there are plenty that are not caused by floods.
Number 3. Exquisitely preserved fossils.
So, like those people at Pompeii? I mean, I guess technically they aren't fossils because of their age, but given a few thousand more years, they would have qualified, and they were preserved in quite exquisite detail.
Some squids with were fossilized with ink still in their ink sacs.
Yeah, fossilized ink. It's not like they cracked open a fossil and found a puddle of fresh ink sitting right there before they used the ink for drawing, which they did. They had to grind the fossilized ink down into a powder and then dissolve it in ammonia before it was usable. So it's not so much ink as it is colored ammonia. I know he hasn't mentioned them drawing with it, but I figured I'd mention it since that is a favorite creationist talking point. You see how I take the time to familiarize myself with the creationist arguments in order to refute the best version of their arguments rather than making up ridiculous straw men that would be easy to refute, but no creationist would agree with in the first place? Give that a try sometime.
And in a classic example of rapid burial, and it's a an ichthyosaur, a marine reptile, apparently, about 6 feet long, was fossilized at the moment it was giving birth.
Or, alternatively, it died while giving birth, because that happens a lot in nature, and so it didn't complete the process. Maybe the act of childbirth is what killed it, maybe it died in a mudslide or something while in the process, who knows? But if you die in the middle of a process that requires you to be alive in order to complete, then you don't complete that process, whether the whole Earth is flooding or not. So, taken by itself, this is neither evidence for nor against the flood.
How does that happen? Boom! Something caught it, and overwhelmed it, and fossilized it. A flood did that.
Or a mudslide, or an eruption, or it just died mid-birth and sank down into oxygen-poor water where it was able to exist without decomposing for long enough to get buried in other sediment, or any number of other scenarios, all of which are way more likely than a global flood. In fact, if this is the specimen that I think it is, which it might not be, there are a few of them, but if it is, then the researchers who analyzed the fossil determined that the birthing process itself is what killed the mother, not a flood.
Only the catastrophic global flood could rapidly bury so many large creatures in layers that are so extensive.
If you assume that they were all buried at the same time, then maybe. But then the fossil record wouldn't look anything like it does. But if we stretch it out over hundreds of millions of years, then that's plenty of time for a bunch of smaller local catastrophes to bury plenty of animals for us to be finding. And if that were the case, then the fossil record would look pretty much exactly like it does.
Number 4. Sediment spread around the continents, covering vast areas every continent. Sedimentary rocks laid down by the catastrophic flood conditions. Many of these sediment layers can be traced all the way across the continents and even between continents.
Yes, and it was actually this realization that provided the first evidence that eventually led to us figuring out that the Earth is older than a few thousand years, because this realization led to our understanding of the rock cycle, which led early geologists to actually conclude that the Earth is infinitely old.
What is the scientific explanation for that? From an evolutionary standpoint, which of course denies, well, pretty much everything.
Projection much? I have seen creationists cite one half of one sentence of a study in order to make their point, when the second half of that sentence would prove them wrong. But, yeah, it's the secular scientists that are denying things.
In Genesis and everywhere else.
Oh, you mean they ignore specifically Genesis? Okay, yeah, they do. Because until such a time as Genesis proves to be scientifically reliable, there is no reason to take it seriously. So, like, obviously they ignore Genesis, just like they ignore the Vedas, just like you guys ignore the Vedas. Would you like scientists to try and make their work fit with the Vedas? No, you'd likely have no trouble seeing the problem with that sort of methodology. But yeah, they're bad for treating the Bible the same way they treat the Vedas. as irrelevant because it is.
Number five, features of the sedimentary layers. Number six, no sign of millions of years between the layers.
Is that the one where nonconformities are a thing that exists because deposition is not universal and constant? You know, that perfectly normal and expected phenomenon that would happen if the sediment were not all the result of one single global event? I feel like nonconformities kind of work against the flood rather than for it. But, I mean, so have most of the other points thus far, so par for the course, I guess.
There should be.
Why? Why would we expect there to be continuous deposition in all locations at all times? Why would we never expect the old layers to be eroded away, especially considering the fact that erosion is a source of a lot of deposition in the first place? I feel like it would actually be physically impossible for there to have been continuous deposition in all locations at all times.
At the boundaries between some sedimentary layers, we find evidence of only rapid erosion. In most other cases, the boundaries are flat and featureless with absolutely no evidence of erosion.
Yeah, that's always how creationists describe nonconformities. I've never really understood this particular argument. It's just weird and nonsensical. Like, even when I was a creationist, I had this vague idea that the evolutionists were trying to shove millions of years into the spots on the geologic column where they couldn't be found, but I never quite understood how these boundaries fit into the creationist picture. I later learned that this is because the creationists almost never explain them properly, instead opting for presenting them as though they are simply places where geologists have decided that millions of years belong without any other evidence.
Which is consistent with no long periods of elapsed time during the global flood cataclysm.
No, spots where there is evidence of millions of years of non-deposition are not evidence for a recent global catastrophe. Again, this is one of those things that is evidence against creationism.
Number seven, evidence in the folds. Further evidence that these layers were laid down quickly, not over millions of years, are the folds we find in these sediment layers.
Is this the some layers are bent, therefore they must have been soft while they were bending argument? Because that one is just bonkers. Basically, the people at AIG don't seem to be capable of comprehending the fact that when rocks get subducted into the Earth, it gets hotter as it gets closer to all that magma, and it gets put under a lot of pressure when there's a lot of rock piled on top of it. What happens when you heat something up to near its melting point while applying pressure? It bends. This isn't really that hard to understand.
They go into the details of that. The moral to this particular story is we have the scientific proof that God's word is accurate.
No, you have some cherry-picked and poorly understood science that seems to at least be compatible with a global flood if you don't look too closely. But you have to ignore a lot of data in order to stay with the global flood as a conclusion. This is not a matter of opinion here. It is a matter of fact. Noah's flood did not happen. At least not as depicted in the Bible. There is evidence that there was a fairly catastrophic local flood in that area around the right time for the development of that particular flood myth to have been based on it, but that would hardly fit with the view of the flood that young Earth creationists hold.
But the world scoffs. Oh, those fairy stories.
Sure, the world are the ones doing the scoffing, while you guys are just full of respectful dialogue, like we saw earlier.
Maybe somebody brought him up there. I know, Ken Ham. He went up the mountain and he just put him there so that you got that evidence. It's all a scam.
If that's not scoffing, I don't know what is. Pot, meat, kettle.
They worship science, and yet, when you show them some scientific work, which is just looking at the fossils, studying them, now interpreting them, of course, is always, that's always an issue that we can bring a subjective opinion to.
No, it is not always an issue that we can bring a subjective opinion to. Sure, there is some room for interpretation with some aspects of paleontology, but there is enough that is not subject to interpretation to conclusively falsify the flood hypothesis. We scoff when you bring your science because you don't actually bring science. You bring creationist talking points that have been shown to be inaccurate for decades. You also don't bring anything positive to the table. I have yet to see a creationist make a positive case for creationism that doesn't rely entirely on just taking Genesis at face value because reasons. The creationist case relies almost exclusively on attempting to poke holes in well-established science rather than trying to establish any of that science for themselves. Why would I trust the creationist model when it can't even provide any evidence for itself, but instead just relies on the assumption that if you can find enough wrong with either evolution or geology or astronomy or some other field of science, then it would win by default? Which it wouldn't, actually, but that's what they seem to think.
But this substantiates the thesis that is given to us in Genesis 9, that God created a world and he washed it out with water. The entire thing, not a regional flood, a global flood. Because remember, if it were only a regional flood, God would not have told Noah to build a boat.
And if it weren't the Ring of Power, Gandalf wouldn't have told Frodo to throw it into Mount Doom. What's your point?
He would have told him to build a moving vehicle, pack up the family, and go to where you're not going to be drowned.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but a boat actually fits that description. But really, this just once again shows that the authors of the story didn't have a full understanding of the scale of the planet on which they lived.
Answers Magazine, the 7 best evidences of the global flood, and a ton of other stuff in that magazine, revealing that this Bible is true. Why doesn't the world get it?
Have you ever sat down and read the thing? It's completely ridiculous. Like, seriously, I haven't sat down and read it thoroughly since I was a Christian, and that is ultimately what made me an atheist, but I'm reading through it with my daughter now, link to that podcast in the description, and now that I don't have the assume it's all true glasses on, it really is quite astonishingly, obviously not true, and we're less than 2% of the way into the Bible as a whole. And that's it for this one. There's a couple minutes left, but he just goes off on how he thinks Moses wrote the Pentateuch and explains why that view is consistent with the fact that the Pentateuch contains an account of Moses' death. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Weldabar, who says, "Creationist logic. Hard water deposits on my bathtub prove a young Earth." Close, but it would actually be hard water deposits on my bathtub prove a young bathtub. Gotta keep it true to the original form. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Mark McManus, Mark Hetchum, Clench Eastwood, Lynn Dobbs, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the scoffers who keep the scoffing atheist that is my channel scoffing. If you'd like to scoff scoffily, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form or listen to my podcast with my daughter, the links for those are also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time.